Welcome to the Rent to Retirement Podcast, your resource for passive real estate investing and retirement strategies. If you're new to real estate or planning your financial future, you're in the right place. Join us at renttoretirement.com to find your path to financial freedom and an easy, carefree retirement. Enjoy the show.
Hey, Renter Retires, it's Adam Schrader here with another episode. And today, believe it or not, I'm joined by Zach LeMaster, the CEO and founder of Rent to Retirement, and nobody else. It's been a while since this event has happened. So, Zach, welcome to Only You on the Show with me.
Adam, what's up, man? It's been a while since it's just been you and I. I mean, I try to avoid our one-on-one conversations as much as possible, but it's good for us to just, you know, talk a little bit about things we got going on. We got a lot of cool stuff going on right now. So, I mean, let's talk about just you personally. What are you looking at right now as far as investing? You have some Florida new builds going on, going through the permitting process, which is a constant delay there. But, you know, you have a large portfolio as well. I mean, what are you doing these days?
I am selling a couple of properties so that I can buy more properties. I mean, believe it or not, I know people talk about the slowdown, but I mean, I put them up on the market and I had them under contract within a week at asking price. So haven't had any real issues there with that, even in the slowdown that we're in. So, which I think is massively overblown, but at least in some markets, I will say, and at some price points. And yeah, like you were saying, I'm still buying in Florida. Getting those builds. I've been told by the team there that my permitting should be done within a couple weeks. So excited to get that bad boy going and get brown broken. So you've been buying some stuff too, haven't you?
We're always buying, Adam. If anyone's listened to me for any extensive time, one of my kind of things I like to hone in on is the simple fact that and we've been investing in real estate for probably about 15 years now, but our first house was just a duplex that we rented out half, lived in the other half. But ever since that first duplex that we bought more and more real estate, whether it's amount of doors or amount just in total portfolio size, but we bought more and more real estate every single year. And that's remained true even this year. So we're under contract with a few different projects. We have a lot of our own builds in Florida. That's where we're very active right now. We can talk about that market. I think the purpose of today's discussion is just to talk about like what's going on. What's going on in the market? What's going on in the real estate industry? What are we seeing boots on the ground? But yeah, we're personally still buying. We're very active. You know, obviously interest rates are a little bit crazy and people are concerned about the economy. Whatever the case is, I mean, the real estate market is still strong in the investment asset class still makes sense if you're approaching it strategically. But yeah, we'll hopefully close. We have a large retail center that we're looking to close before the end of the year. We're buying another short-term rental. We have some builds in Florida and probably a few other small multifamily that we're still evaluating. So it's kind of crunch time. We're trying to fit in those last minute tax benefits. But
are you going to pay no tax?
Last year we wiped out our complete, we had a significant loss, which rolls over. I mean, that's an important thing to discuss is that when you have those passive losses, I mean, we are real estate professionals. We're out there actively investing and managing properties. Last year we were able to have a significant loss and that should be the same case this year, should be the same case next year. You know, that it just, and we have rollovers from there as well. So that allows us to actively invest and put that capital that we'd otherwise turn over to Uncle Sam back into our own portfolio. So, but we're doing what the IRS wants us to, which is going out and creating jobs and creating, affordable housing solutions and just stimulating the economy through our activity. And so, you know, that's a fun part of being an investor.
Did you get a card from the IRS saying, "We're so sorry you lost money last year. Hope you were able to survive"?
We got a significant refund in 2021 because we did pay a good amount of taxes in 2020, but you know, no thank you cards. But it was nice this year not to have to pay quarterly estimated taxes. That's something I didn't think about until we were actually, you know, like, hey, we don't have this large expense that we got that's due quarterly. because we, you know, wiped out our taxable income with losses last year. So
nice. So it's always sad to not write a big check to the IRS, crying all the way to the bank, or not going to the bank, I should say.
Yeah. And you know, we have some naysayers out there. I mean, don't hate me for this. I mean, don't categorize me with Donald Trump or anything that are, you know, I mean, people are out there, real estate investors, you know, especially with the 2017 Tax Act, like with 1031s, cost seg studies, with, you know, opportunity zones, like all these things, they're out there. The IRS is putting them out there for people to take advantage of. And they're not loopholes, right? I mean, this is what the IRS is this is what they want you to do, is going out and, you know, making things happen. This is also what drives the economy to some degree. So, and some of those tax benefits are becoming less attractive or not accessible over the next few years. So it's important that we're active, but let's not hone in on taxes too much, because you're going to get me on my soapbox. But let's just talk about the state of the market today. Adam, I mean, you're in the weeds every single day talking to investors. You're an active investor yourself. What are some of the common concerns that you're seeing right now? I think the biggest one is people are concerned about interest rates. They're concerned about where the economy, where they have this almost fear or anticipation of like what's going to happen to the real estate market. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah. So those are the two big things, is what's my interest rate going to be? And is this house going to be worth nothing in, you know, a year because of the housing crash that, you know, people are talking about? And look, I'll be honest, I wouldn't want to go out and be buying a $4 million flat in New York right now as an investment property, quote unquote. And, you know, and I wouldn't want to be a real estate agent for that either, because you're probably not selling it. So that is not an investment property, because that is probably not going to cash flow. And that is, and it's what I talk about. I've talked with some people here in the Austin area where I am, and they say, oh, well, you know, can I invest in Austin? And I'll say, no. You know, right now, there are some markets that are just strictly an appreciation play. And right now, in those markets, this is not the time to be buying for appreciation. you're probably going to lose money for a little bit. And then in the future, maybe it will grow. But if you focus in on the areas where, you know, it makes sense, and where the houses are actually, you know, rentable for a profit, especially what we're looking at, which is more like starter homes, which I read an article over the weekend that 6% of the homes being built in the U.S. right now can be deemed starter homes. 6%, that's it. 6% of the ones being built are starter homes. So these homes that we have available don't exist. That's what I tell people. If you're looking at the properties we have now and being concerned that the prices are going to drop, they're not going to be worth anything. The question is, we talk to them all the time about where are you going to put your money if you don't put it in real estate? The question is, where are you going to find these houses if you don't get these houses? They're not around in today's world.
Yeah. I think you bring up a lot of really good points. I mean, generally speaking, when people are fearful about, you know, just what's going on economically and fearful about the real estate market and interest rates and things like this, they're not super savvy investors, and that's okay. Like, this is what we're here to do, is help educate people and give you some guidance on how can you be a successful investor in any market, including today's market, right? A lot of people want to jump back to 2008, which we really, in the media, loves to exploit that, right, as a fear factor that gets headlines. So, but we really need to just stop talking about 2008 altogether, because it was a very unique scenario, and by no means are we in any capacity close to where we were, based on the supply and demand, the type of loans that were being offered. It's just a completely different time. I mean, we're, 15 years now later. So, I mean, you just have to look at where we're at today and what does the future look like. And so to be very specific, I mean, what is happening right now across the market? I agree with you 100%. I think the larger, more expensive markets that has had 40, 50, 60% appreciation on those houses over the past 2 to 3 years, obviously, that's not sustainable. I mean, no one expected that to continue to go on forever. And so we need a correction at those house price points. And interest rates will cause that, you know, because a 1% to 2% increase in interest rate, that removes a lot of buyers at those kind of higher price points. It also creates more renters, right? It puts a lot of people into that renter profile. And so that's the way you should really be thinking about building a portfolio, is being in the areas where you have the highest demographic of renters. And that's how you build a sustainable portfolio. Same thing like again, I don't want to hone on 2008 too much, but I mean, during that period of time, like there was a huge mass pool of renters, people that unfortunately lost their homes, people that were speculative investors. And I'm glad you brought that up, because we are not speculative investors. We invest for fundamentals, and that's what served us well. I've never lost a house my entire life. And that's basically because we invest in fundamental rental real estate, which is cash flowing below the median house price point, right? I mean, and also what's happening is institutional buyers, they're coming up and they're scooping up these single family houses, especially in these affordable markets. And so what happens when they buy those portfolios of houses is they basically are off the market probably forever, because they'll just keep trading them with other institutional money. But those are not accessible to the average investor and to the homeowner. And so they're actually pulling away. They're causing a hindrance on, they're not helping the supply and demand. So they're kind of causing a hindrance of the accessibility to housing. Coupled with that, we have large population shifts to certain markets, the markets that we like to invest in. And there is a huge demand for housing, and the supply is not able to keep up with that from how construction is going right now. So, I mean, there's a lot of factors, and we only broke the surface on a few of them. But fundamentally, if you're wondering what to do right now, don't change what has worked for hundreds of years. I mean, invest in fundamental rental real estate. Housing is a necessity. People always need a place to live. Don't be a speculative investor where you're looking at, you know, banking on appreciation, banking on an exit, right? Like one thing, flippers would be a category of people in some of the houses that we have going on. Like, yeah, there is a concern there. We just had a Portland house that we were looking at $1 million exit. You know, we were all into it for about $700,000. And we just sold it last week for about $800,000. So it's still profitable, but not to the point where we were supposed to be. And so that's my point, is those higher end houses, when you're speculating, which you are, when you're flipping and trying to exit, not as a rental. I mean, those are things you need to be careful on. But as far as bread and butter housing, just, you know, invest in the area where there's a diversity of industries, where you have high rental demand, where the numbers still make sense. Interest rates are irrelevant in that. It doesn't matter if your cash flow is compressed $50 a month. Rates in these type of environments, we see rent increase more dramatically than you know, when it's the opposite, when people are out there buying houses more so and you have less renters. So being in an area where you steal cash flow, and then a high inflationary environment, devaluing capital, being highly leveraged, still cash flowing in areas that, you know, have a diversity of industries, is about the safest place you can invest in. And those are recession-proof houses below the median house price point. Did I miss any of the criteria, Adam, that I like to rant about?
Well, I was going to say, you know, you talk about, you know, the state of the market right now, but one of the important things to think of, at least with the properties that we're dealing with, is they're going to have at least, at a bare minimum, 10 years of life left on all of the major systems. So if you look at a 10-year period in U.S. real estate over, you know, the last at least 70 years, I think probably longer than that, but I know at least in the last 70 years, there has not been a 10-year period that hasn't been flat, if not greater than flat. So right now, if you're concerned that, you know, even if you decide, you know what, Akron, Ohio is going to drop 20% next year. It's not, but let's just say it's going to drop 20% the next year. Well, historically speaking, even if you bought it at today's price, in 10 years, it's going to be worth more, as much, but probably more than what it is today. So the question is, are you going to give up 10 years of cash flow just because you're concerned about what might possibly happen in the next 1 to 1 year, 1.5 years, something like that? So are you willing to give up all the benefit, the tax benefits, all of the cash flow, everything else that's going on, just because you're concerned about what might happen in the next 12 months?
And to be very specific, we'll dive into markets that we are active in, that we like more so than others. This is our business. We always have a good pulse on like where the opportunity is. We're always looking for new opportunity. But also where has there just been consistently, you know, performing houses and markets? And those are the areas we've been in the longest and continue to stay in. Historically, that's the Midwest. I mean, those numbers really work. They're not huge fluctuation markets. You know, they're just your bread and butter housing solutions that are still affordable. That's a really safe place to park money. And so if you're wondering like what to do, you got 50, 30 grand, whatever the case is, what do you do with that right now? Because that is a question and you brought that up. Like, what else are you going to do with your money? You always need to have a plan with money. If you're waiting, if there are a lot of people fall in this category, well, I'm just going to wait and see what happens. I'm going to wait. Like, no one that's really successful is just sitting on the sidelines waiting. They're creating a strategy to be successful consistently in any market. And that's truly the recipe to success, is always taking action and sometimes just being a little bit fluid and dynamic to adapt to whatever the market gives you, because it's always going to be changing. I mean, that's the only constant, is constant change, right? And so we're all aware of that. But the fundamentals stay the same. But yeah, I think being in the Midwest, I mean, really, and so many of our investors are focused heavily on cash flow. They're looking at a pro forma, which is only year one potential projection. And they're looking at that to say, oh, what is my return on investment this year? And while we showcase that publicly, I almost hate that, because it puts people in this mindset of like, oh, well, I'm looking at what is my, you know, $200 cash flow net, and that's a 13% cash on cash ROI. I mean, and they're really letting that drive their investment decision, but they're missing the big picture, because how people build wealth in real estate is by leveraging and taking advantage of the tax benefits, and also positioning yourself where you can have appreciation over time. But really it's the leverage aspect of it. If it has to boil down to one thing, it's actually, you know, putting down a small percentage of your own money to partner with the bank that puts down the majority of the money to own 100% of an asset. And that's really what it's about. You really can't do it to the extent that you can in real estate in any other asset class. And so that's what makes people rich in real estate long-term and creates generational wealth, is using leverage to stretch that capital further to allow you to have a higher return on investment, to get additional tax benefits using leverage, as well as just physically owning real estate and letting the tenant pay that down over time. So, I mean, it's important to keep that big picture. What do you think, Adam?
I love something I heard probably 15, 16 years ago when a guy was talking. He said, if you want to know how safe and secure real estate is, just try to go to the bank, give them $20,000 and tell them you want $100,000 to invest in the stock market. And good luck. Good luck getting that loan from them. But if you go there and give them 20 grand and say, I want $100,000 to buy a home, you're going to get it, as long as your basic finances check out. And the banks are not stupid. Banks are not designed to lose money. So if the big money is saying this is a safe investment, you know, I tend to agree with them on the grand scale of things. So, I mean, it's, you know, leveraging and making yourself bigger, like you said, is the way, because, you know, all of the appreciation that happens is yours, not the bank's. You know, the bank is just taking, you know, their principal and interest payments year after year, and you're getting that principal back whenever you sell. So it's just, you know, you have to at least increase your cash flow by the amount of principal you're putting in every single month. So, you know, that's, I mean, it, to me, it's probably other than, you know, if you put it into a government backed security, it's going to be, you know, if you get like a bond or something like that, that's probably technically speaking safer, but you're going to be getting, negative 6% return on that right now, today's environment. So
yeah, here's an exercise I would encourage most people to go through, which I don't think many people actually spend the time or possibly even know how. And we are building out a calculator that is going to be a portfolio tracker. So you can punch in, you know, five different properties, whatever you have. And it has amortization scales based on the loan structure, and you can input whatever rent amounts you want, and increase in rents and appreciation percentage, whatever the case is. But the big thing that I love looking at is, because really this is conceptual, is, and this is where a light bulb went off for me when I actually ran the numbers on larger type of properties we were buying, is like, okay, how much debt is actually being paid down on this? And in year one, it's minimal, right? Because the banks front load those loans with interest. But if you really look at this over a 3, 4, 5 year period, as you continue to add properties every single year to your portfolio, it's significant. I mean, I don't like talking too much personal details about our own portfolio and what we're doing. I know many people are curious, but we have seven figures every single year of debt pay down with our own personal portfolio. That is significant. We didn't start there, but we continue to grow our portfolio year after year. And we really actually don't sell a lot of the real estate that we buy. We trade up via 1031 sometimes, but we have a very large portfolio, which if we're just looking at the cash flow, that's why cash flow doesn't matter. And I encourage people to actually get that out of their head right now when you're looking. And this interest rate thing is what's, you know, compressing cash flow, and it's causing people concern. If you just, you know, break out and run the numbers sectorally on all those different things and look at an amortization scale and say, if I bought 5 or 10 houses and let's say they cash flowed zero, the break-even cash flow, let's say they had 2% appreciation, very minimal, whatever, or even don't even factor that in. Just looking at the debt pay down, like what's your return on investment just with principal reduction? It's huge, and it compounds year after year because every single principal payment, every single mortgage payment you make every single month is more and more principal. And so that's, I love looking at that as far as like, okay, we're building equity both through appreciation and debt reduction. And that graph gets exponentially higher, you know, just year after year owning properties, letting real estate do what it does. And that also puts us in a position where we can say, all right, we can go out and do, you know, we can pull out equity on this and reinvest that. And that is a non-taxable event to pull out equity. You know, that it's huge. And that equity wasn't there. Like we're creating that just from owning rental real estate. So I would encourage, I guess my point is run the numbers on that and kind of look at the big picture of rental real estate. Those that get it, they get it. And that's why they are consistently buying. But if you're looking to get started or continue to scale your portfolio, you're concerned about where the market is, where the interest rates are, just understand like, yes, you want to be positive cash flow. But there's point in times when your properties aren't positive cash flow. If you have vacancy, right? Like that stuff happens. That's why it's important to have a portfolio, but you really have to conceptually understand what real estate is doing using leverage long-term. But Adam, let's dive into the markets a little bit and talk about where some of the best opportunity right now. We're going to do a separate kind of summary on Southwest Florida and some of the new construction throughout Florida that we're working on, because we have a lot of really interesting updates. We finally have a good amount of people that are coming full cycle on those. I know it's been a waiting process and frustrating process for everybody involved, ourselves included. We have a lot of our capital invested in those builds that we just had to extend loans on, but I mean,
builders included.
What's that?
Builders also included in that frustration.
Right. Yes, every builder, you know, it's everything under the sun, right? We had a bunch of owls that moved into some of our lots, and during mating season, we couldn't do anything for them. I mean, that was a whole, you know, crapshoot. But anyway, but the point is the market's still very strong. We have some case studies that we're going to go through and actually interview people about their experience. Kind of the common consensus is that everyone's frustrated throughout the process. Everyone's happy when they get to the end result. And they say, I think the average equity position is about $150,000. And rents have gone up 22% last year than what we projected. So, I mean, it's a great market, but it is an uphill battle to get to the finish line. But we have a lot of people that have cash out refinanced and pulled all their money back out, possibly even extra. We have people that have sold their properties. I think the highest I've seen to date is $190,000. Gross margin difference between build costs and sales costs, and that was about 18 months. So it is an exceptional market. You know what we're seeing, because we have a lot of people that are investing in Cape Coral. We'll just do a quick summary on this. Average house prices we're seeing for like a, you know, 1700 square foot house, four bedroom, two or three bath. This is probably around that 390 to 420 range on average. We've had some people that have sold as high as 450, 460 based on location and lot, you know, where they're at. Rents right now we're seeing in that $2,500 to $2,600 range. We initially projected 18 months ago around the $1,900 range. So those have gone up. Things are still leasing out less than a month. It's still an exceptional market. Now we're seeing some slowdown in terms of, you know, stuff not going up 20, 30% in 1 year, which is okay. That's a good thing. We still anticipate strong appreciation in the future, and we're still very active there. We have some new interesting opportunities with duplexes and things like this. Definitely still worth considering. And if you are already investing in new construction with us, I mean, you know, just be patient and understand. I mean, reach out if you have questions by all means, but also understand that the market is still strong and we're right there with you. It's an uphill battle. There is an end in sight, and it's an exceptional market still. Adam, what about the Midwest? What are you thinking right now? What if you had to choose your top 2 to 3 markets as a whole? We're removing Florida from this because we talked about it. What would be your other top markets you would recommend to people right now?
Yeah. I'll get into that in 1 second, but just, I want to go back to when you were talking about loan pay downs and everything. What you have to remember also, people, these 30-year loans you're getting, you're not going to hold them for 30 years. You know, you're looking at 5 years or so, then you're going to either sell or refinance and pull that cash out and get a new interest rate. So like Zach was saying, when he talks about ignore it, it's not going to be around for 30 years. So, you know, get that thought out of your head. But I would say right now, my top market would be the, for the rehabs, is going to be the Akron, Ohio, the Massillon, Canton area. I don't know if you're
suburbs, Cincinnati, right?
Yeah.
Cleveland.
This was actually rated as the, Redfin called it the most recession resistant economy in the United States today because of the, it hasn't had that massive significant jump. The debt to income of the people in the area is still solid. The flipping activity in the area is not that high. And so it's, they called it the most recession resistant area in the country right now. So that is my number one top recommendation to people. If you're looking to get into the turnkey rehab, you know, prices anywhere from 130 to 180, 190, somewhere in that range. You look at just wages of people in the area, you know, in terms of rent growth, because we have seen significant rent growth. Well, guess what? The national average of rate growth in the last year is 6.7%. Summit County, which is where most of these areas are, was 9.4%. So, you know, you're talking about 50% over the national average in terms of wage gain. And so the wage growth is consistent with the ability to increase rent. They haven't just been jacking up rent and now people are going to be in this horrible situation where they can't afford to pay it. No, they've gotten pay raises, and wages, as we all know, are very sticky. You know, how many times has your employer come back to you and said, oh, I'm going to need to drop your pay by, you know, 10%. You don't mind, do you? You know, that just, wages are very, very sticky in the world that we're in. So that would be my top market probably. You know, it's got the economics of it. The industry is solid. It's like a manufacturing base. And so that's my top market. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I agree with you. We've seen a lot of, interesting stats on Akron as a whole. And one thing across the board that we've been looking to do where we found a lot of opportunity is some of these, what we would call secondary markets, almost like suburbs of large metropolitan areas. You know, that usually there's less crime, there's more stability and, you know, occupancy and quality type of tenants. I really like those suburb areas, and we've been quite well. You know, Akron is a growing area, but it is still accessible to Cleveland, right? For people that need to work in the city or close mm-hmm. to it. But they get that suburbia kind of feel, and I think that has a lot of draw. My other market I would throw out there for the Midwest is Kansas City.
Yep.
Kansas City is a market that I've been investing in for probably 12 plus years, and I absolutely love it. And the same concept applies there. Some of those, this is on the Missouri side where you have better tax structure, but the suburbs of like Blue Springs, Independence, Raytown, like some of those areas, we've just been done very, very well. You can still get into a house, a B to upper B class house for under 200,000, 150 to 200,000. You can still get a decent return on investment. And those are extremely stable markets. And I think that is to your point. I mean, that's what we call recession proof real estate. If you just want a bread and butter house that chugging along and, you know, you're going to own it for a significant amount of time, I mean, that is a good place to park money right now. Absolutely. I mean, if you're looking at new construction, probably Florida is a place to go, because I still think there's a lot of upside there. Almost every single property, by the time it's completed, whether it's, you know, already in progress or brand new pre-construction, there's equity. There's an equity play there. But we do know Florida as a whole has a tendency to have some fluctuation. The Midwest, historically speaking, it's just been a very stable market, you know, stable rental income, high demand. And I agree with you 100%, Adam. Yeah. What else should people be thinking about, or what other markets might be worth considering, or other opportunities?
Yeah, well, it got me thinking when you talked about kind of the areas in Kansas City where we are. I remember talking with Dave, one of the workers here, and I was talking about, you know, oh, what properties in Kansas City right now are, you know, the best neighborhoods. And he was kind of doing a map of them and looking. He goes, oh, this one right here in Blue Springs, that's only like 2 miles from where Scott lives. So, and I don't think anybody here lives in a terrible neighborhood. So it was just funny to be like, oh yeah, it's a, this one's a good one. It's right down the street from his house. So,
I mean, these are not low income areas. I mean, we've been there, done that. We don't really focus on low income anymore. I mean, there is some people that is their core business model and they do quite well. And when, let me make this clear, when I say low income, we still have Section 8 tenants, and that's quite all right. And Section 8 tenants in better quality areas, they still need to qualify, and you know they don't want to lose their voucher. A lot of times we get questions about Section 8 tenants. I mean, let's talk about that actually, because that's a question sometimes where the new investor, I've had this conversation multiple times over the past few weeks of someone saying, well, I don't want to allow Section 8 because you know I've heard bad things. And you know, then I kind of dive, peel back the onion a little bit and say, well, what do you know about Section 8 and why else are you concerned? Well, there's this kind of, I guess, negative connotation that Section 8 is not going to take care of the house, that there's going to be additional expenses, you know, dealing with the government is a pain in the ass, which that part is absolutely true. But
that's why I have a property manager, though.
Yeah, exactly. And one that's familiar with it. I mean, what's your opinion on Section 8 or how do you handle that conversation, Adam?
So to me, I've had both Section 8 and cash pay, and I will, just to be completely honest, I've had good and bad Section 8 tenants. I've had good and bad cash paying tenants. I mean, it's just, you know, it's the area that you're in is really going to dictate everything about it. I mean, you can't just say this person needs government assistance, so they're going to trash my house. Well, that's possible. But it's also possible they'll be a great tenant, because it's quite possible that somebody who's paying you cash, you know, they might mess up your house, or they might be great for your house. You know, it just depends. At least with Section 8, you have the ability, you have the kind of thing looming over their head of, if they mess this up, they get kicked off government subsidy. What are they going to do? A cash pay tenant who leaves your house and you have to go after them and get a judgment against them. Guess what? Probably still not going to pay.
Yeah. The way I approach this discussion with people is just to say, remove the Section 8 aspect out of it. You know, look at the tenant. You still need to vet the tenant exactly the same. And you brought up a good point, just being in a good area. You know, that's really what's going to have statistically more people, and also having higher rents. I mean, that removes a lot of like the lower end type of potential issues that you would have is just being in kind of those lower C and D class areas where you have rents that are under, you know, $1,000. I mean, I think that puts you in a higher risk, but generally speaking, I inform people just remove the Section 8 out of it completely and vet the tenant the same way. And that really, in my opinion, is what allows you to set yourself up for success in occupancy is the vetting process that goes into the tenant. And sometimes you need to have that discussion with your property manager. You need to have visibility on the applicants that are coming in. We allow pets and everything, and that's completely fine. And that's actually been a way that we can increase and be creative to increase rents. But Section 8 is completely fine. Yes, there's a delay sometimes after you get a signed lease with receiving your payment. Yes, you got to go through government inspections. Most everyone fails a first inspection. Like, it is what it is. That doesn't mean your rehab was bad. It's just, you know, everyone fails it. Even brand new houses, that it's like they're, it's a requirement to fail the first inspection so they can say they did their job, and then you go out and make those fixes, have them come out, and most, like 90% of people pass a second inspection. But to your point, the biggest benefit is the fact that these tenants are highly motivated to keep their voucher, right? There's subsidy from the government, and if they screw up, they could potentially lose that. And there's a long wait list of people that need government assisted housing solutions, and so you know, they're usually motivated not to let that go. Yeah. Actually, my longest tenant to date, which has been in the house for, you know, just the same tenant, which is over 8 years at this point, is a Section 8 tenant. And they're partial subsidy, but they've never missed a month of payment, and they've taken exception. And we've raised the rent every single month. So I'd encourage people, look at Section 8, look at the area. I mean, often also with Section 8, the benefit is sometimes you can get a qualified voucher above what market rent is. And so there's benefits there as well. So pros and cons, but generally speaking, there's still people too. They still need housing solutions, right? I mean, and they can still be exceptional tenants, and you can have good or bad tenants, market tenants or Section 8.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's something you just have to learn. I always just tell people whenever you get into it, you know, just so you know, this area is mostly Section 8. There's nothing wrong with that. I just wanted to let you know, because you need to know kind of what your tenant base is going to be for sure. But yeah, good and bad either way. I'm the opposite of you. I tend to go with no pets. I know you can charge pet rent and get a good return, but I tend to go no pets unless there's, you know, if the vacancy starts getting a little bit longer, I might go that way, but I tend to skew towards no pets in my properties.
Yeah, definitely something to discuss with your management team and see, like, you know, there's, because I do think there are some important things to look at. Like it was one of my managers that was saying, like, you know, you actually get about a 40% reduction in applicants if you don't allow pets, if you don't check off that box. And that could be geographically speaking as well, but that's something we've decided to do. I mean, we've definitely had a couple of pets that have destroyed flooring and baseboards, and you know, there's certain yep. breeds we don't allow dog wise, and we have a limitation on it. But I think all in all, taking extra pet deposit, increasing, you know, the rent possibly $50 a month or whatever, we probably come out ahead. Well, I know for sure, but definitely something to look at and discuss with your managerial team on what's right. And it's important that you have, you know, common or often discussions with management to make sure you're on the same page.
Yeah, and some managers, I've actually talked to one manager who said, yeah, we don't have, our system doesn't let us collect extra pet rent. And I was like, well, if you don't collect pet rent, I'm sure as heck not allowing pets in my property. That's
well, that just makes no sense, Adam. You need a new property manager. So
I'm not with them
new software.
Anyway.
I don't know. But well, I guess to kind of summarize, I think generally speaking, what I would encourage anyone out there to do is still be an active investor. Don't get into this common fear of the sky is falling. Be strategic and intentional about what you're buying. If you are concerned, if you don't understand something, reach out, have a discussion with us or somebody, just take action and do something. Real estate has been a viable investment class for a significant amount of time. There's been more millionaires made in real estate than any other asset class. Some people have figured it out, right? Like a good portion of people have figured it out and figured it out long-term. You know, and you just got to do that. You got to get some guidance. You got to avoid the common pitfalls and mistakes that a lot of people do. And, you know, you just got to have a plan and you got to take action.
Yep, absolutely. So if you want to reach out to us, that's at renttoretirement.com. That's renttoretirement.com. You can schedule a time to talk with the strategist, such as myself. We're happy to do it and walk you through kind of how you're going to progress in your journey. You can see the properties with their cash on cash returns at on our active inventory sheet, but Zach suggests you cover that part up and just look at the long-term aspect. But you can find all of that at renttoretirement.com. Don't forget to leave us a review on whatever podcast platform you utilize. If you have any questions, send them to podcasts@renttoretirement.com, and we'll talk to you on the next episode.